Good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Tuesday, June the 26th, 2018. 14 minutes past the hour, you're tuned into the Now program. Scott Spears along with you for the ride. And we have got a great guest this hour. I'm going to get to her in just a moment. But I do want to remind people that we will be at the Marion County Fair next week, July the 2nd through July the 6th. We'll be broadcasting from the Veterans Memorial Coliseum. Monday and Tuesday, we will be broadcasting the live harness racing from 10 a.m. until 3 p.m. That event is supported by the committee to elect Jeff Ratliff prosecutor. The first 300 people to visit the WWGH booth will receive a commemorative fare book. So stop by. We'll also be giving away prizes to Zumbezi Bay, COSI, the Columbus Zoo, and Tecumseh. So don't miss that. All of our programs next week emanating from the Marion County Fair. Now this hour, we are going to go back in time and remember one of the all-time greats. You probably remember him best in movies such as The Blues Brothers, touring the country, and taking a song that was really one of a kind and making it his own. Let's go back in time and listen to the legendary Cab Calloway.
Story about Minnie the Moocher. She was a low-down hoochie-coocher. She was the roughest, toughest frail. Minnie had a heart as big as a whale. Heidi, 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 ho!
Heidi, 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 ho!
Nobody like Cab Calloway, and of course, Cab Calloway passed away at the age of 86 in 1994, but we are so happy, proud, and honored to be joined today by his daughter, Kameh Calloway Murphy. Miss Murphy, how are you?
I'm pretty good for my age and whatnot. I think I'm doing pretty good.
I'm glad to hear it. When you hear your father perform his signature song, what does it make you think about?
Well, it makes me think about, you know, how much he enjoyed life, how much he had great concern for his audience, and he started out with this participation, call and response. And another thing, how wonderful his diction was. I mean, you sort of understand every single word that he's singing. I think once they called him the Basil Rathbone of jazz singing. So, anyways, those characteristics, I think, make me very happy to hear his music again.
He was born in 1907. That time, that's, boy, 60 years before the Equal Rights Amendment. Women did not have the right to vote yet. Did he talk much about his childhood?
Yeah, he did. He was born actually in Rochester, New York, and his father at that time was really trying to get a job. I mean, his family had been associated with Lincoln University, and his grandfather had graduated from Lincoln, and his father had attended Lincoln. But and his father had some training in law, but it was just very, very hard to get to get a job and to feed your family. So he moved the family up to, his father moved the family up to Rochester. And there, supposedly there were some jobs there, and so Cab was born there, but the family couldn't make it up there, so they came back to Baltimore, where his grandfather was, and they lived with their grandparents. And he had a really strong background in the church and in church music, and his mother played the organ, and his aunt played the organ in the silent films for in the theater. So he had a wonderful musical background, and when he came back to Baltimore, he was able to have some very fine music instructors when he went to Douglas High School.
You were born when Cab would have been in his early 20s.
Right.
What was your earliest memory of him?
Well, I was not, with him. It was not what you would call a family situation, mother, father, and whatnot. I was living with my mother. He was traveling. They never formally married, and so I was, I only saw him on occasions, and he just, was so, just bigger than life, like he was some wonder person, like I was looking at Superman or something, but anyway, he was, he always had these very soft kind of clothes or cashmere coat or something that I could touch, that was tactile, that I could feel, and those are some of the things that I recall in seeing him and being close to him. And there was an odor, an aroma or something that the backstage of the theater always had. It was like a mixture of perfume that the chorus girls used and cigarettes and probably booze that they were drinking on the side. But there was that kind of theater odor that I remembered. Whenever he came, there was sort of an aroma around him.
What kind of father would you describe him as?
I think he was just an ordinary father, really. He had girls, all girls, and he was pretty strict. He would, come home and in later years and be fussing about all the lights on in the house, that kind of thing. And I remember one time I was in the front room, and he was, and I had, several lights on, and so I said, and he was going around turning off the lights. I said, I'm doing some reading here. I can't see what I'm doing. And so he said something like, well, Abraham Lincoln became president by firelight, so you don't need three lights on for whatever. But he was always checking up on how we were progressing in school and in our studies. And he discouraged me from about show business, but I was really not that interested, not that much of, have that much of an interest in show business. But some of my younger sisters, he encouraged them and helped them to get roles in some Broadway shows. And one of my younger sisters made an early record with him, Little Child. And they were, you know, they were really into the performance type of thing. And I wasn't as much into that.
In 1931, Minnie the Moocher goes to number one on the charts. Again, this is 35 years before Separate But Equal. This is a very different time. What was that? Do you remember that time when that skyrocketed up?
Yeah, well, I was still, you know, kind of young in 1931. But I remember when I was a little girl going to the theater and seeing him perform and seeing the audience sort of respond to him just like they did for the Beatles and Frank Sinatra, and, you know, the women would be running down with flowers or screaming when he came on stage, and when he would shake his head and his hair would go all over, they would you know, kind of go crazy. And it was that kind of excitement that was really around that song and around his performance. It was quite a big deal. It was not as much as that, like the Beatles, but it was close.
When you got to be in your 20s, an adult, what was it like to be adult with your father? What did you learn about him as you grew older?
Well, he was, he sort of gave a facade of happy-go-lucky and sporting life and that kind of thing. But he really had gone through a lot of hardships in sort of maintaining his career. He had to play in the South. Everybody pretty much had to go South because, you know, he played at the big theaters in New York, Paramount, and this, that, and the other, but earlier than that, you had to make money, and so you had to go where people were or wanted to hear your music. And he had, you know, there were a lot of insults, and sometimes it was very difficult. And he had a real concern more about his band than he did about himself in those situations. And he would, he hired a train, like now people, you know, have their own jet planes. He had his own train, and he would take his band from one place to another in the train, and then if there was no place for them to lodge or to board, he would use the train as their hotel and their place to really stay. Because in many of the places where he played, if you had that many people, you didn't have a hotel or a residence that was large enough to house everybody in, although many of the black people who were in the area where he was would, you know, open up their homes to the band and to him and serve food and whatnot because they couldn't eat at the hotel.
Did
but he was... you know, he had a lot of Indian blood. He could have what they call passed. He had, you know, very straight black hair. He could have sort of gone for something else, some foreign kind of identity, but he never did. He always he was a strong believer in the African American heritage, and so he never went what they say on the other side.
In 1967, he co-starred opposite Pearl Bailey in an all-black cast change of Hello, Dolly on Broadway. What do you remember about that time in his life?
That was a period where he had to abandon his band and fortunately for him, he had had very good voice training and some theater training at Douglas High School. And he used his strong voice and his theatrics to do Broadway. And of course, there was, you know, Porgy and Bess, that the Gershwin brothers admired him and wrote a part for him in their folk musical. So he was very lucky to be able to have some versatility and to be able to sort of lead a band music and go as a single in concerts and stage plays and things of that type. And of course, he had hired Pearl Bailey at one time as in the Zanzibar, one of the clubs that he was playing. And so he knew her personally, and she, you know, she chose him to be Vandeveer in that in Hello, Dolly.
He had such interesting people who he performed with: Pearl Bailey, Moms Mabley. Do you have any remembrances of these people? Who people today? I don't even know if they remember Pearl Bailey or Moms Mabley.
That's right. Pearl Bailey, you know, had this very low-key style of singing. Remember, she used to do that song, "Tired." I'm tired of you know, this man evidently who was mistreating her and whatnot. And she had a very distinctive voice and she had this hand movements that were very, very sultry and very different and arresting. And Moms Mabley was always fond of my father. She and when my father played the Apollo in New York, Moms Mabley would always want to be on the on part of the show, and she had a lot of jokes, you know, about my father, and he was her favorite. He was her boyfriend, not so much because he had money, but because he was good looking, and she wanted her children to have straight hair or something like that. She always had, you know, a lot of jokes, and again, she was one thing on stage, and she's a very astute businesswoman and whatnot off stage. She knew she knew how to read a contract, so to speak.
You know, all entertainers have interesting lives. They have a hit, and it makes them known, sometimes all over the world. And then it does come to an end at some point. In the late 60s, your father wasn't really where he was in the 30s. What's it like when that huge fame starts to go away?
Well, again, it's very frustrating. But he had an agent, and he had incorporated himself at one point, so that most of what he was making came to him. There was a lot of performers that weren't able to do that, and a lot of their money went to other people who had sort of underwritten them at some point and then took most of the profits. But my father was lucky. He was married to my stepmother, Nuffie McNeil, and she sort of saw him through that particular period, and she had worked for many years with the NAACP and with many of the major organizations, and I think she kind of gave him some ideas of some of the things that he could do. Because at one time, you know, he was with the Globetrotters, and he was their halftime show when they were playing basketball, and that was one of his loves. He loved basketball. But anyway, you know, I think he was surrounded by people who were saying, you know, this is not the end. You've got such talent in so many ways that you can make it through this, which he did.
Very interestingly, as you say, the 60s and 70s were not a huge high time for him. And then at age 73, 1980, here comes the Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
How did that come before he took the role? Did he want to do that? Did he like the idea of it?
Well, I think he had been in Cincinnati Kid. He had been in several roles where, you know, he was a gambler or he was he played some kind of supporting thing to a situation in film. And I think that Belushi and his partner kind of saw themselves as jazzy guys, and they admired him so much that they really sought him out to be in that film, and they looked back, you know, at some of the early race films that he was in, and that this Heidi Ho, they thought, could still be a signature kind of thing for, I mean, it's even for the country, because at various football games here in Maryland, when the Ravens play, they did a kind of a Heidi Ho, you know, before at certain points of the game, and so they were very I think smart to get him, because they were, you know, really kind of parodying jazz and whatnot more than being expert performers or whatnot, but they did have one expert performer in the picture, and so that was good.
And
they had several expert performers, but Cab, I think, was outstanding in that picture.
And I want to take people back to 1980. Saturday Night Live had only been on the air for 4 years. This movie was not a high-budget movie, was not supposed to be a gigantic success, but it was. And it created a whole resurgence, I think, for Cab Calloway. Certainly the Blues Brothers live on today, House of Blues in Chicago and other places. Mm-hmm. When that came out and became such a hit, and people knew who Cab Calloway in a whole different generation was, what was that like, the 80s, for him?
Well, yeah, at that time, I think that Janet Jackson and a few other people had some interest in him. And there was a... I think because that film was had so much action. It was one of the first kind of action films of driving through the mall and, you know, the fires and all that kind of thing. He was really lucky to be in that. But he was a gambler. And he liked to bet on the horses and whatnot. And he would bet on, I think he just bet on himself and bet on these guys that this was going to be something to catapult his career. And it, you know, it certainly did. I mean, he was on the Muppets and then he started getting, you know, TV shows and little spots here and there on TV, which brought him back into the mainstream. So it was just luck, really, that he was part of all of that.
As he approached his 80s, in the late 1980s and into the early 90s, what was his life like during that time?
Well, he slowed down, you know, quite a bit, but he was still a, you know, he still had this urge to perform, and we would go to the theater or a club or something, and everybody would be holding their breath, you know, would he be able to make it and see it through? He became very ill in Japan, and he had a couple of other incidents where, you know, in the 90s and whatnot, he was showing that his health was not 100%. But he had such determination about, you know, his music, his performance. He had to do this, he had to do that, and he was very stubborn, you know. He was older, and he was bossy enough when he was younger, so when he got older, you know, we were walking around sometimes on eggshells trying to placate him and let him know that... we all knew that he had great talent, that he could go on stage, but we thought it was best that he not do it. And that was a difficult thing to do.
Do you remember where he gave his last performance or what year it was?
No, I don't. I should really sort of research that. But I think it was a concert he did. He was doing a lot of concerts with symphony orchestras and performing a lot of the Gershwin numbers and things like that. So I'm really not sure where his last performance was. But my son Christopher would probably know, because he then followed up with the Cab Calloway Band, and when his grandfather passed, he took the band out and just to keep, you know, his name alive and whatnot. And he had graduated, Christopher had graduated from the New England Conservatory, and he was a musician, so he kind of knew what he was doing. He did pretty well.
Yeah, absolutely. When your father stopped performing, when you had that, your family had that conversation with him, what was his life like in those last years?
Well, he had several strokes, and he had to be hospitalized, and he was in therapy for quite a while. We had played the music in his room, and I remember he was very, very sick, but his foot was still going back and forth to the beat of the music. He always liked the outdoors, so we would go and wheel him outside, you know, and he sort of enjoyed that, and pointing out various flowers and birds and things like that. He really enjoyed that. And he still wanted to play the horses. We said, no, you know, you can't do that. You don't know what you're doing. You know, your brain has been affected by this stroke. But he was a what should I say? He was a person with a lot of confidence in himself, and I think when you have that kind of confidence in yourself, it goes on even when you have major illness. And he just still thought he could do what he couldn't do, but that was in his, it's just in his DNA, and he you know, he just had it. That's basically it.
On November 18th, 1994, Cab Calloway passed away at the age of 86. Do you remember the last time you spoke or saw your father?
Yes, I do, because I was there when he passed. And I was living in Baltimore, and so he was in a hospital for a sort of a medical center in Delaware with my youngest half sister, and his wife was there, and so she called to tell me that you know, he looked as if he was passing. And so I got up there before he passed, and she went out on the balcony to have a cigarette, and while she was gone, it was just the nurse and I, and the nurse, you know, said to me, I think he's going. And I said, well, how can you tell? And she said, well, his feet are very, very cold. And she said, and generally it comes up. So anyway, he was, but he was, you know, his eyes were open and he was responding and, you know, looking to people. And I held his hand, and he looked up at me and whatnot, and I said, she doesn't know what she's talking about. I said, he's nothing's going to happen. And then he sort of looked as if he was trying to pull himself up, and then he fell back on the pillow, and he was gone.
Mm.
And, you know, it to me, it almost felt sudden, because when I looked in his eyes, I just, you know, thought, he's fine, you know, nothing's going to happen. But, you know, God does what he has to do, so.
Absolutely.
That was it.
Was he able to speak prior to that day?
No, he wasn't. Mm. He wasn't. He was just sort of making grunting sounds, and he would point to things, or if he wanted to go outside, he would indicate that he wanted to go outside. He would smile, he would respond to various people, but he was not able to speak at all.
When you look at Cab Calloway, it's been, what now, we've got 24 years since he passed away. He's still well known. What is the legacy that he left?
Well, I think he made a great impact on American culture. Not only his music and his sense of music and jazz, but he nurtured, you know, some of the finest players in the country. Dizzy Gillespie, Jonah Jones, Milt Hinton, all of those major players were in his band. And he was a real leader. In fact, they used to call him Fess for professor. They thought, you know, he was like a teacher. He was very insistent upon, you know, their giving their max, they playing at the top of their game. He had an effect upon dress. He didn't invent, but he certainly did the zoot suit and made that a style at one time. And then I mentioned that he had this wonderful diction and told stories in his singing songs, and made it like you were listening to somebody, like a storyteller. And so he I think he made a great contribution. And in this wonderful articulation that he had, I remember Nat King Cole came to the house, because he had, Nat King Cole had this sort of southern, very southern accent, and he didn't want this southern accent to kind of interfere with his very sophisticated music that he was singing, and he came to my father to help him. And so he made, I think, sizable contributions. And of course, for a black man to be making millions at early on, when in the 30s and whatnot, and to have an impact on places like where you're living in Ohio and where I am, I'm in a little small town in Maryland, Hobbity Grace. And so, you know, the impact, as you go back and researchers and people look at what he did, it's formidable. It's, you know, it was no small contribution to American culture.
You know, it's interesting. I always wonder this. When he lived a pretty good long life, 86 years old, did he know that he was Cab Calloway, that he had created something that was very unique, that he was this celebrity?
Yes, definitely. He was born on Christmas Day. And, you know, he called himself the King of Heidi Ho. And so, you know, we used to tell him, you know, just because you were born on Christmas Day, you are only the King of Heidi Ho. Don't get beyond yourself. But, oh, yes, he knew who he was. He was proud of who he was. I think he had his big concern was that people were happy, people were enjoying what he was doing, and that he was being some kind of an inspiration to young performers who wanted to go forward. So he had a sense of himself, I think, right up until the end.
It's interesting because being the child of a celebrity is something most of us will never know. How was he at Christmas dinner, Thanksgiving? Did he like to sing Christmas carols? We know he was stubborn. Was he a good grandfather? What kind of man was he?
Yeah. Well, he always went to church services at Christmas. He was an Episcopalian. And if he was off on a Sunday, which was rare, that he wasn't traveling or doing something on the weekend, he would attend church. He had, I think, a deep spiritual feeling. His sister, Blanche Calloway, who was also a performer and they were sort of parallel at one point in the 30s and early 40s. And she was a not Seventh-day Adventist, but Mary Baker Eddy. She believed in that religion, and she had an influence on him, not only through the music, but through trying to make sure that he had good character and that he had some spiritual bearing, that he wasn't just sort of, you know, floating out there. So I think that his contributions and his hard work, because he had a very high work ethic, and he was there no matter what, you know, sick, well, whatever. He was on the job, and I think that all of that was inspirational to his daughters and to his grandchildren. He loved his grandchildren, and he, you know, he liked to fool around with them. We had boys, and so they would be doing basketball and, you know, other kinds of, he loved sports, and so his band had a little baseball team at one time, and he was a good role model for his family.
It's kind of interesting because he became very popular in the 30s. It lasted until the end of his life. And for the majority of his career, the height of it, he was performing in places where there's certain hotels he couldn't stay at, things of that nature, separate but equal. What did he think of his fans? Did he like to be interviewed? Would he do an interview if he were alive today?
He would, but I don't think he would do it as long as this one. But he was a little bit on the paranoid side. I think most performers are, you know, questioning people's intentions and things of that nature. But he was cooperative. He tried to be cooperative, signing autographs and doing stuff like that. But he was it couldn't go on too long. He didn't have this long attention span he was, I think, probably as a child, he may have been kind of hyperactive, because there was some story about when his aunt was playing the organ at one of the theaters, that Cab would come but he'd be running around the theater and whatnot, and so she put him under the organ. She had one foot on the pedal of the organ and the other foot on him. But he was a very active and a person. So I think that that his, you know, what he would do or how he would cooperate was somewhat limited. He wasn't like running around looking for people to interview, like that kind of thing.
Well, this has been fascinating to learn about a man who was so pivotal, and I think in so many people's lives. You cannot hear Minnie the Moocher and not smile. It's just one of those songs. Before we part ways today, is there something about him? You told us about the stubbornness, but is there something that you know as his daughter that we would not know about him because we only saw him as the performer?
Yeah, I think there was a sense of sort of a lost area within his psyche, and I think at times he was concerned that he had not gone to college, that his mother had hoped that he would go to this Crane College in Chicago and become a lawyer, and he had gone out there and found, you know, his sister was in a club, and Louis Armstrong was involved with it, and Louis Armstrong was interested in Cab, thought he had talent, this, that, and the other. So, but I think there are times that he just wondered what his life would have been like had he not done that, but gone on into law. So, you know, everybody, I think, at some point has these what if things, if this had done, if I had done this, if I had done that. I think he had that also. But in general, he was a very kind and thoughtful, not thoughtful in the sense of sending birthday cards and that kind of thing, but he was his mind was always on his family. He had a great sense of family, and he helped where he could, and And, you know, and we're grateful. I'm particularly grateful because I'm 91 years old, and I think that I have inherited some of his stamina and some of his, you know, sort of focusing in on doing things and not, you know, letting the world go by you. And so I'm you know, eternally grateful to have been his daughter and to have shared some of his talents and some of his love.
Absolutely.
So that's
no, it's absolutely true. Somebody just sent a question real quick before we part ways. Where did Minnie the Moocher come from? Do you know how that came to him?
I think there was some kind of an English song, something that came from England that was, because, you know, this was a very slow and, you know, like the St. James Infirmary was sort of in Britain that they called hospitals more than the infirmary. But I think, I don't really know the origins of the song, but I know it was done with another writer, and he claims that, my father claims that he was singing and this song, a song, and forgot the words and just did the hidey-hos in to kind of cover a piece of thing. I have always questioned that particular story because he has always been so precise about, you know, everything that he's done or presented or sung or whatever. So so we're not sure. And then he said that that he used to, in Baltimore, there was another guy who he knew who had this very loud voice, and they would stand on four blocks away and yell at each other and whatnot. I don't know. You know, it's all kind of folklore-ish at this point. But the origins of the song, I think, you know, came out. They are definitely attributed to him.
Absolutely. Kameh Calloway Murphy, the daughter of the legendary Cab Calloway, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a lot of fun.
Okay.
Thank you. Have a great day.
For this day, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
And the Charlie Evers Show, 1:10 to 3 p.m., all broadcasting live from Veterans Memorial Coliseum. During our live programs on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, giving away tickets to Z-Bay.